from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Advocates for survivors of domestic abuse fear that the stress of job losses, school closures, or California's stay-at-home order could lead to higher rates of violence. We learn why the risk is elevated and how organizations are trying to help. Then health policy expert Andy Slavitt joins us, the former acting chief of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, who also led the team that repaired the healthcare.gov website, says it's not too late for the federal government to act boldly to lessen the toll of the coronavirus pandemic. Welcome to special coronavirus coverage from KQED. I'm Mina Kim. Advocates are worried that stress and isolation, two things many are feeling right now, could lead to higher rates of domestic abuse in already volatile home environments. The COVID-19 pandemic and the state's stay-at-home rules further complicate the situation for survivors. We look at how advocates and shelters are trying to redouble and retool their efforts to keep people safe. Joining me is Krista Nimzik. She's public policy manager at California Partnership to End Domestic Violence. Thanks for being on with us, Krista.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Kolzaria Henderson. She's executive director of CORA, Community Overcoming Relationship Abuse in San Mateo. Thanks for joining us, Kolzaria Henderson.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, Kolzaria, I'll start with you. Are you finding that survivors are struggling to access your services because of the pandemic?
We are. We are finding that on a normal circumstance, it's difficult for survivors to be able to reach out for help. They're often navigating their abusive partners, trying to figure out ways to contact people, to talk about options. And now with the shelter in place and the COVID-19 pandemic, we're finding that survivors are really struggling in order to find a safe, confidential place in order to talk about options and are really needing additional relief.
And what are you trying to do to try to enable or reach out to folks to see if they need help or support?
We are working really heavily in our law enforcement programs at our organization. We support all of the law enforcement districts in our entire county. And so we're working really heavily with our law enforcement programs to ensure and to prioritize domestic violence survivors, even though there's a time when there's a lot of need around us in our community. We're also looking at other ways to safety plan with survivors. Normally, we are looking at, we are talking with survivors about in-depth safety planning where they are preparing to leave a situation. And often we may now only get a few minutes with them. They may only have a couple minutes in a closet or outside. And we need to take that those just a few minutes and ensure that we can help get them to safety quickly. So we are definitely, we've expanded some of our services, particularly our hoteling services, to help get people out of the situation fast. We are also exploring alternate technology, right, that to utilize to reach out to survivors. We're finding that we're utilizing text message technology as well as email in order to maximize the benefits to reach people.
Are you trying to increase your hoteling in part because physical distancing rules have made it harder to put more people in shelters or the usual numbers in shelters?
So, yes. Also, that normally we'd be working with a myriad of domestic violence programs in the Bay Area and talking back and forth about their own shelter space as well in order to get people quickly into a domestic violence shelter if we did not have space in our two shelters. But because of the COVID-19, where, you know, everyone is trying to scramble and ensure that social distancing does take place, and so that often the same coordination between shelters is not available because we're all struggling. And so, yes, we have drastically increased three-star hoteling, and at a time when hoteling is extremely expensive.
And Krista Nimzik, of the California Partnership to End Domestic Violence, I know that you're an organization that hears from basically providers across the state. What kind of support are they asking for right now?
Yeah, thank you. I think we are hearing similar impacts that Kulsaria laid out all across the state, the challenges of how to reach and serve survivors in this moment, and especially how to provide them with safe housing options as shelters are full and not exiting survivors from shelter in the midst of a stay-at-home order and a pandemic, and therefore struggling to figure out how to provide safe housing. One of the most urgent needs, honestly, is additional financial resources for programs to be able to meet this moment. The spring is often a time when fundraisers happen for local programs, and we've heard from a number of organizations that had large in-person fundraisers planned for late March, early April into May, and all of those have been canceled. That comes at a significant financial impact for programs. Programs often rely on, you know, the small businesses in their community that donate food if they're restaurants, donate services and supplies, and donate money. But as our small businesses are hurting in this moment, we also know that's having an impact on what they're able to give. And so it's essential, and a large part of my work is lifting up these needs to our government leaders to make sure that as we respond in real time to this emerging crisis, that the needs of domestic violence survivors and the programs that are doing phenomenal work to step up and meet this challenge, that they aren't forgotten and that the funding follows to help them. You heard Kulsaria talk about how many folks they're putting into hotels, and hotels in San Mateo are not cheap. And there aren't yet additional resources that have been provided to help domestic violence programs meet that.
Yes, that's what I was going to ask you, whether or not resources are coming, if this is reaching its way to state coffers and that they are likely to be able to provide them to you.
You know, we haven't seen those dollars come in at the moment. We continue to have regular conversations with the governor's office to help them understand the need as they work through the emergency funding that they are trying to allocate to different areas of COVID response. We work closely with the legislature to make sure they're aware of this need as they think about, you know, additional funding that may be needed when they come back into session. And this is a big part of our federal advocacy as well. There was some funding included in the Federal CARES Act that passed just a week ago and that I know has been lifted up many times. But those dollars, once they're spread out across the nation, won't be nearly enough to meet the need. So it's a kind of all hands on deck. We know that meeting this crisis requires everybody to get involved, and we'll keep lifting this issue up at the state level to make sure that it's part of our state's response.
We're talking with Krista Nimzik, a public policy manager at California Partnership to End Domestic Violence, and Kulsaria Henderson, executive director of CORA, Community Overcoming Relationship Abuse in San Mateo. And we're talking with you, our listeners. What are your questions for our guests? What are your questions about the situation that domestic violence survivors are facing or those in volatile or threatening living situations? What are your questions about how services are adjusting during the pandemic to address some of the concerns? The number here, 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter or Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. Krista Nimzik, can you speak to why there are increased risk factors as a result of the pandemic that is causing you concern that we'll see an uptick in domestic violence? Economic stressors, I'm sure, is one of those.
Absolutely. Economic stress is a risk factor of domestic violence, and that's true at all times. But as we've watched, over a million Californians have filed for unemployment during this crisis. The economic impact that it is having is putting real stress and pressure on families. And so whether there was violence and abuse happening already, or if, you know, a relationship that may have been on the brink has bled into violence and has become abusive during this time of stress, we are very concerned about that. It's also another piece that we're concerned about is the significant increase in firearm sales that we've seen at the start of this pandemic. And as more firearms are in the hands of individuals, we know that that is a deadly combination. When we see domestic violence and firearms present, the risk of lethality is far higher for survivors of domestic violence. And also, even when cases don't lead to death, the presence of a firearm is well demonstrated to increase the severity of the physical violence that is experienced. So we are worried about what we may see in those conditions. And more broadly, I'll say that a key dynamic of domestic violence is that survivors, excuse me, survivors feel isolated and alone and trapped and with few options when they are experiencing domestic violence and the power and control that their abusive partner places over them. And right now, we're in a situation where it's easy for all of us to feel isolated and alone as we're told to shelter in place, to stay distanced from individuals. And so I think one message we're trying to get out is that while it's incredibly important for public health reasons that we all keep physical distance from each other, that social connectedness is incredibly important, that survivors know that there are options out there and that they continue to reach out for help, but also that friends and loved ones continue to check in on the people important to them in their lives and to keep those connections, to make sure that folks are healthy and safe, in the fullest meaning of those terms.
Well, I'd like to bring our listeners in, and I'll start with Mallory in Oakland. Hi, Mallory.
Thanks so much for taking my call. And ladies, thank you so much for the important work that you're doing. My question refers to some of the women that you're taking in. And why is it that the hotel prices are so high? Is the federal government or the state or even the counties helping to offset those prices for you, especially since fundraising is down during this time?
Kulsaria Henderson, do you know?
Yeah. I'm not, I think some hotels are probably they're hurting and their business is hurting, and so I'm guessing that they are struggling as they're struggling themselves, that those prices have continued to rise. We are paying, so we try our best to have hotels that have kitchens, particularly for families with kids. And in that price range, we're looking at upwards of about $1,500 a week per family per room, and that is just for the smaller units. And so when I, with a family of with three kids, we are seeing an uptick of about $1,700 to $1,800 a week for that family. And for the pandemic, if we're thinking about that it this could go on. So for that one individual family, we might be paying that price for the next 8 weeks. We're unsure.
Well, Mallory, thanks for the question. This listener says, "I'm a survivor. Perpetrators can be using child visitation as a way of intimidating and abusing the women and endangering her and the child's life." Kulsari Henderson, can you speak to this? Because I've heard of this too.
Yes. We're actually starting to hear stories and cases. Our legal team is working tirelessly at this time, even though the courts are very limited, and we're hearing cases where that where survivors are not getting their children back from visitation, where there is people are not following the court orders, or the fact that even advice around court orders aren't necessarily still applicable around visitation, even during the pandemic, which is not true at all. And courts are struggling to be able to address these issues during a restricted time. And so we're definitely seeing survivors that are also more at risk because they're not able to go to approved places and public places in order to exchange. And so they have, we've actually seen some incidents of physical violence that have occurred because
they weren't able to get into a public place where they normally would exchange and have been at more at risk from the abusive party. So it's definitely a concern that we're monitoring.
And let me go next to Rich in Mountain View. Hi, Rich.
Hello. I really appreciate this topic. Thank you, everyone who's doing this work. I myself used to work with CORA in the teen dating violence program, and it has me curious as teenagers are more likely to not be seeing their intimate partners. I'm curious if there are resources for folks who might be experiencing more online or phone-based abuse. I'll take my answer off air. Thank you.
Colzaria Henderson, or even Kristen Nimzik, if either of you can speak to this. Colzaria?
Sure. Yeah, there we actually are working with folks that are experiencing abuse in a lot of different ways. And Rich, you mentioned that you worked with a youth program. Our youth advocates actually have also seen an uptick in need to reach out to our folks that are experiencing a lot of our dating violence. And they are definitely seeing an increase to the tech, what we call tech abuse, right, or technology abuse in this era.
Yeah, and this is Krista. I'll just add in to say, when we think about young people, we're not only thinking about how programs are adapting their tech to help support youth who are experiencing violence, but also this is where a tremendous amount of really essential prevention work happens. And for prevention advocates who are looking to work with youth on building healthy relationship skills that will hold them in good stead throughout their lifetime, you know, the schools and the athletics and other activities where they typically engage young people are obviously not in session as our normal structures. And so prevention advocates are getting really creative about how they're reaching out to youth to continue engaging them through social media, through video, through all sorts of different ways. And while we continue to respond to this crisis and meet the incredibly urgent need, we also know that part of the long game is continuing to invest in and build prevention efforts across the state so that we don't continue to see high rates of domestic violence continue. So we're working hard to, you know, not take our eye off the ball of supporting that long-term work at the same time that we're also working hard to support immediate crisis response.
Kristen Nimzik, advocates for domestic violence survivors, and also for youth, they are definitely sounding the alarm about concerns of an uptick in violence. Are you seeing some real numbers around this? Are you actually seeing this playing out in data?
We are. And I will say it is still early to have a tremendous amount of data, although it has felt as though the COVID pandemic has been impacting our lives for an extended period of time. It has really only been within the last month that we've seen such dramatic impacts of COVID-19. But we are already hearing from programs about increased number of calls to their hotline. Some local law enforcement agencies have already noted an uptick in calls for domestic violence response. But those patterns aren't yet necessarily impacting every community the same. And I think one piece that's an important sort of comparison point is that whenever we see a natural disaster happen, it's not uncommon that in the specific moments of that disaster, that calls to domestic or sexual violence hotlines can decrease because individuals are trying to meet very urgent needs of shelter, food, you know, how to physically survive and have basic needs met in that moment. But as immediate crisis passes, we have seen time and again that domestic violence programs are inundated with a flood of calls for help, increased crisis needs, increased counseling needs. And so even as I talk to programs across the state that are telling me it's quieter right now, they all know what they are bracing for is long-term impact and an uptick to come in the weeks as we continue to shelter in place. And the long-term trauma response needs of survivors, even you know, in months to come as we return to a more normal way of being. These needs of survivors experiencing violence right now aren't going to go away, and programs will still need to be there to meet that need 8 weeks from now, 8 months from now, and 8 years from now.
Well, let me go to Ruth in Los Altos. Hi, Ruth.
Good morning, Kosaria and Kristen. Thanks so much for taking my call. It's Ruth Darlene from Women SV. It's a domestic violence program here in Santa Clara County for women involved with powerful, sophisticated abusers. And I'd like to get your comments on the problem of processing restraining orders now in courts, with so many of the courts closing down. Sometimes restraining orders are lapsing, expiring, and then that puts women at increased risk. They're also running out of options for places to stay if they leave. They were planning to stay with friends before or family members who are now afraid because of the coronavirus. And often there's a lot of financial abuse, too, where their partner is threatening to stop working, or they can't pay support anymore because of the pandemic. So comments on any of those would be most welcome.
Thanks. Kosaria Henderson, in terms of processing of restraining orders.
Yes. So for us, for CORA, we are continuing to work on restraining orders. We actually have a separate legal line in which we are able to help and work through the process of paperwork. Unfortunately, right now, a lot of the normal places and services that would be there to support someone filling out the paperwork can't be done in person. And so we're working really intensely and over the phone with individuals that want to still process the restraining order paperwork. We are finding that court is being continued, right? Courts are issuing continuances that are upwards of 30 and 60 days in some cases. And because of that, we're not sure when some of the other orders that come with the restraining order might be issued. Some of the other custody orders, those pieces might actually be issued. But we are definitely continuing to work on processing restraining orders, and yet we know that some of the temporary orders that are, you know, upwards of no more than 5 days are a struggle right now with the court system, and that people are not able to necessarily get in and get the and access all of the orders in a timely manner.
Well, Kosaria Henderson, we're coming up to the end, and I'm wondering if you can just remind listeners what are the numbers and resources to call.
Yes, absolutely. So all of our we have a 24-hour hotline, our emergency shelter services, we are up and running. So if you need assistance at any point in time, please call us. Our number is 1-800-300-1080. Again, 1-800-300-1080. And please reach out if we can help.
And the National Domestic Violence Hotline is 1-800-799-SAFE. Kosaria Henderson, Kristen Nimzik, thanks to both of you for being on with us. Kristen Nimzik is Public Policy Manager for California Partnership to End Domestic Violence, and Kosaria Henderson is Executive Director of CORA, Community Overcoming Relationship Abuse in San Mateo. Really appreciate having you both on, and thanks to our listeners for their questions and comments. Another half hour of special coverage of the coronavirus from KQED is next, so stay with us. I'm Mina Kim.